Welcome to the To Read List. I'm Bailey, and this is a podcast where I attempt to get through the 125 unread books on my shelf. With me, as always, is my friend Toby.
Hey.
My brother Andrew.
You just lied. Toby's not always here.
Okay.
I still feel abandoned.
And my husband Dylan's the sound recordist.
Hey.
Andrew, are you like I'm really into the truth?
I'm just playing around. I know Toby had good reason to miss out, but it's just nice to hear his dulcet tones from back from across the pond.
We missed you, Toby.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Oh, thank you. It's nice to be missed. I didn't miss you guys at all.
Wow.
I was so busy.
That's fair.
I missed you guys too.
How was your trip? How many books did you read and how much shame did you acquire?
Wow. I got some shame, but we'll talk about that in the shame section. I will say I think I read zero books.
Whoa.
Because Ancillary Justice defeated me. I really tried. I really tried, and I really liked it at the beginning. But Bailey, I think in the end, I might agree with you. It's not for me, even though I think it's far more up my alley than it is up yours. It's one of those books that like slows you down and down and down in your reading progress. And then finally you're like, oh, I'm in like quicksand here and I like have to get out or I'll die. And it wasn't that bad. That makes it sound really bad. But yeah.
I just need you to know that I have a very smug smile on my face.
Oh, I know. You don't have to tell me.
It's like, okay, we'll see how you feel about it.
For some of us who maybe space out when y'all are talking to me, what's Ancillary Justice?
Ancillary Justice is a Hugo and Nebula, I think, award-winning novel by Anne Leckie. It's a science fiction book. Came out maybe 10 years ago.
Is this the book where the ship is a person or the ship is not a person?
The ship is a person.
Okay, yes, I remember. This is coming back to me now.
Yeah, the ideas in it are so cool. I really admire what she's doing. I think, honestly, just a case of not for me in the end. I really admire it. But yeah, it slowed me down. So zero books read on vacation, which is tough.
Yeah. Okay, well, sorry about that. But, you know, get to the real stuff. What shame did you get?
What shame did I get? I got given shame, which is always the sweetest shame.
Whoa, the sweetest shame.
Thank you. I'll actually tease that this is normal shame, but I will expose to you a great shame later in this podcast. So that's my teasing.
Okay.
So my normal shame is... My lovely sister-in-law, Claire, and her husband, Jordan, gave me some gifts of shame. First of all, they gave me the gift that I'm reading right now, which is Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver.
Do you feel smug because you've read David Copperfield?
I feel incredibly smug.
Awesome.
Because I really enjoyed David Copperfield, but at points I was like, ooh, this is long. Like, is this worth it? And now reading Demon Copperhead, I will say 100%. It's so cool to know all of the references she's doing and to kind of know what's going to happen next, but to see how she's going to interpret it in her way. It's hard to say I recommend reading this gigantic book before you read this other gigantic book, but if you feel so inclined, I would read David Copperfield before you read Demon Copperhead. So that's one. And then the other one they gave me is this book I've never heard of called The Late Americans by Brandon Taylor. It gives me like Little Life vibes. Mm. Like there's a lot of pictures of like sad men on it.
Heck yes.
Yeah. And I read the synopsis when they gave it to me, but I've forgotten what it's about. but they recommend good books, so I'm fired up about it.
Seems a little bit threatening. Like yeah. Here's a picture of dead American men.
They're only sad.
Welcome to England.
That's my shame.
I look forward to your great shame.
Yeah, well, it'll come. But how about you guys? Any shame?
I am shameless. You might notice that I am down to 125 books.
Oh, ooh. Down to the number you started
the
with.
The number I started with 5-6 years ago. So yeah, feeling smug. This is the theme of the episode, smug. What about you, Andrew?
I'm smug because I have no shame and I didn't have to. Oh. I'm not back to the same number I started the podcast with. I'm shameless and ready to party. So there.
Awesome.
Amazing. Bailey, I was wondering,
yes.
Have you checked out, because I know you read kind of against your will, the Three Body Problem books. have you checked out the show?
Great question. Again, smug. I feel smug because I have read the three books and, you know, it was a slog. It took a lot of energy. The first one especially, but then once I got to the second and the third, I got more into it. But when I was done, it felt good. And then, 5 years later, this trailer comes out and now the show is really big. I have not seen it yet. I am very curious because a lot of people are talking about it. I think the Game of Thrones guys are the perfect people to do it because I think they're into this like epic world building stuff.
Yeah.
But like, I'm curious because the first book, as I mentioned, is really heady, is really math focused, but also a lot of the crux of it is like discovering that something is going to happen in like 100 years or some whatever time it is. And so it's like there's not a lot of immediate tension. So I'm curious if they're incorporating stuff from the other books into it. Have you been watching it?
Yeah, I've checked it out. I haven't finished it. I will say it's a real mixed bag. There are some parts of it that are really, really good and some parts that are not as good. I will say I really appreciate it. And I think you'll appreciate that, like, there's a line somewhere in one of the episodes where one of the characters is like, wait, so we're all like this frustrated and upset about people playing a video game? And it's very, for me, who I had my frustrations with the first book as well, being kind of weird and slow. I think that's a fun line in there for some people who might be like, oh boy. But yeah, and I think the first season does a good job of kind of like blasting through the first book and getting into some of the meat of the second book already in the first season. So good.
I feel like they have to.
I haven't finished it yet.
What about the line where they say, wait, so are we inside kind of three body problem? And then looks at the camera.
They do mention the three body problem quite a lot by name. So
the three body problem is the video game. Yeah, I guess I have to watch it.
Well, Toby, I hope that this is where we find out what your great shame is. But first, I guess we got to know, did you read a book this week?
I did. I read Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot.
Blue.
Place in the universe.
With billions upon billions upon billions of stars.
I was going to practice my Carl Sagan voice, and then I forgot to do it.
It's actually really easy. All you do is do a Kermit the Frog voice, and then just lower it, and then slow it down a little bit.
In Pale Blue Dot, Carl Sagan presents.
That's a little bit too much Kermit, I think.
Well, I was thinking you sounded like the villain in Silence of the Lambs.
Well, it's funny because you think...
It puts the dot in the pale.
Yeah.
All right. So, log line. In Pale Blue Dot, Carl Sagan presents a series of essays, some leaning more scientific and some more philosophical, all with the aim to inspire both humility and courage in humanity as we look toward the stars.
Da, da, da.
Or at least that was my impression, as I didn't finish the book. That is my great shame. It is the ultimate shame, perhaps. I would say greater than any amount of books that you could have to report for shame.
Oh my
gosh. Wow. So this is the first time this has happened on this episode, on this podcast.
Well, okay. Yep. This is my great shame, I will admit. There have been, like, throughout our history of 5 years, whatever, maybe two books that I haven't finished by the podcast. Like, I had, like, under 50 pages left that I skimmed to the end and then finished after recording. But this is new. I've never admitted it.
Wow, am I the only one who's a Puritan about this?
It's coming for you.
Toby, I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Did you just think I'm just one dot in the universe, like it's not worth it, like
the grand scheme matters? Does it even matter?
Well, the crazy thing is I've finished books that I liked so much less than this. Wizard's First Rule. But yeah, I'll kind of get more into it. But yeah, that's my great shame. All I can do is apologize, Pejos. I'm still going to do a review-ish. But you know, go into it. I got like more than halfway through.
Toby, I love this. This makes for a good episode.
I know. That's what I thought.
I will back Toby on this, that I remember reading this and it take years to read this thing because like Carl Sagan is a great teacher. However, for some reason, this book is both introductory and not introductory.
Yes, that's exactly right, Dylan. But I will jump ahead to that's a mini orc of mine, which is some of it is so basic, like the stars, the center of our solar system. And you're like, yeah, yeah, come on, Sagan. And then he goes into like the chemical composition of like the center of the sun in like granular detail. And you're like, okay, whoa, whoa, too much. Okay, let's back up. So it's possible that you do not know who Carl Sagan is, because not everyone is as old as us.
So this voice doesn't make sense.
Exactly. You just think, what's wrong with Dylan's Kermit the Frog impression? Carl Sagan, I don't think I knew. I knew him like kind of as a popularizer of science and a celebrity figure. I didn't realize before this book how serious of a scientist he was. He was like big deal, like leading scientist of his day status. So that's pretty cool. When he wasn't doing serious science, he was doing very Neil deGrasse Tyson things, popularizing science, like evangelizing about how cool science is, in a very savvy way, especially in this book where it's like he seems to be doing it because he loves science genuinely and loves kind of the mystery of it. And also as a kind of person who understands that money gets science done. And the more people who are interested in science, the more people will make decisions to be like, yeah, I think we should pay for this stuff that, you know, at first glance might seem to some to be like a gigantic waste of money, but really does turn out to be some of kind of the biggest stuff that humanity can do and does have benefits in the long run, at least. That's what he thinks.
This sounds like to me, like when you have kids, you need to feed them vegetables, but they won't eat the vegetables. They're like, here's ways to grind up vegetables and hide them within the pasta. That's what it sounds like. It's like, we're going to make this seem really fun, this science stuff, and then we're going to sneak in some composition of the sun.
It's true. Sagan was also, he worked very closely with NASA in his day on the Voyager missions. He was a major part of the Golden Record, which shooting something out into deep space that kind of tells who we are and where we are seems like a bad idea.
So you're saying if aliens come to destroy us, it's Carl Sagan's fault?
Yep.
Great.
And that... in part, probably. that leads me, strangely, into my orcs and elves.
The elves are the first 50 pages. The orcs are the stuff I didn't read.
Oh, you are so correct. You don't even know. Elves first. I would say Carl Sagan is a fantastic writer. I think I tend to enjoy him as a philosopher, an inspirational writer, more than a science writer. The inspirational bits of the book are really, really amazing. The book is named after a picture, which I'll go into, but the bit of writing about that picture is called The Pale Blue Dot Soliloquy. And it's really a beautiful and inspirational piece of writing. The details behind The Pale Blue Dot are basically one of the Voyager missions, the one I think without the Golden Record, was basically an unmanned mission kind of shot out into the endless vastness of space, using planets to kind of like slingshot itself around and get eventually all the way out of the solar system. And that mission had basically a camera on it, and they were taking close-up pictures of the different planets, which was very exciting at the time because we didn't have many pictures that were taken outside of our atmosphere. So we got a lot of really interesting images. But taking those pictures was very complicated because you had to give instructions to the camera from Earth, obviously. That was very difficult to do, and it costs money to do it. It's all this stuff. So Voyager took all the pictures it was supposed to take, and it was about to leave the solar system basically forever, to disappear and be gone, you know, beyond where we could contact it anymore. And Carl Sagan, very savvy, very knowing how to kind of fire up the imagination, said he wanted Voyager to take one last picture. He wanted Voyager to turn all the way around and take a picture of the Earth, but a picture of the Earth from the edge of the solar system. So basically, all that you can see of the Earth among a billion, billion stars is this teensy tiny blue dot. And that is the kind of conceit of the book, is it's both kind of a lesson in humility for humanity. Like, look, that's all we are, is this teensy tiny speck in the unimaginably huge vastness of space. Couldn't we think of ourselves as a collective humanity, as privileged to be on this planet, but also need to be a little bit more careful, maybe, about being on this planet? And then also as an inspiration, like, you know, we can do something as amazing as sending Voyager out into space. It's an amazing technical achievement, and we can do incredible things if we work together. So, great piece of writing, great imagination, really good eye for imagery, and just... yeah, an amazing man.
Okay, and then?
Yes, and then what happened to me?
So that's Carl Sagan, the like philosopher, and I really enjoyed those. I really enjoyed those parts of the book, and maybe there's a lot of those in the back half. Of the book, but I didn't make it there, because in between that and the end of the book, there's a lot of my orcs. The first part of of my orcs is not really the book's fault. I think I've discovered something about myself, which is, I don't care about space that much. I wish I did. I really do. But I have concrete evidence, and it is this.
Okay, we already have the pull quote for that for this review. Right, yeah.
Don't care about space that much. This is a really interesting book because usually these books come out and they're very of their time. It's kind of like, this is where the state of science is today. And you read them and you're like, wow, think about what we can do in the future. But this book came out in 1990. And he does a lot of teasing in this book, like, just imagine, you know, we're setting this mission out in the year 2000. And imagine what pictures it'll take. And I kept thinking to myself, like, I could look up those pictures. Those pictures are out there now.
I don't have to imagine.
And I just didn't. And then I just didn't over and over. Like, he was like, imagine when we can plumb the depths of Venus's clouds. And I was like, I'm pretty sure we've done that. And just, like, didn't look into it. And then, you know, exactly what Dylan described, it kind of seesaws back and forth between really, really basic stuff and really, really complicated stuff. Not like ultra complicated, but like more complicated than the casual reader was interested in. So that really bogged me down. And then one of the other things about it that kind of slowed me down was that this book has a tone to it where it's trying to convince you of some stuff that I already believe without even thinking about. Like, I believe in climate change. Mm. I believe that we as a species have kind of at best a 50-50 chance of surviving the next couple hundred years. Like, these are things that I think maybe in 1990 were like, listen, you must listen to this message. And now I'm just like, no, I know that message maybe too well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not Sagan's fault, but that was also kind of, it slowed me down. Yeah. And that's kind of the end of my review. I don't know if I can call it a review. Like I said, you know, I didn't want to not come here and not talk about the book. I don't feel super great about quote unquote reviewing it when I haven't finished it. So I'm not going to give it a star rating because I don't think I can do that.
Plus, stars are light years across from each other.
If I can ask just one question, Toby, mm-hmm. How dare you? No. what was the moment where you were like, I can't do it anymore. I need to stop.
I think it was like the third chapter in a row that was hard science.
Mm.
Like, I think there was like one chapter that was hard science and I was like, okay, cool. That was the hard science chapter. And then there was another one that and they all start out in the philosophical vein. And then they like rip the curtain back and you're like, surprise, it's actually about hard science. And I was like, oh no.
They should structure it like a choose your own adventure. Yeah. Like, do you want the hard science version?
or do you just want the book cover so you can put on your bookcase and say, I read that.
I also think that, you know, he's very popular as the creator of the TV show Cosmos. And I think some of this stuff really benefits from visuals. Like, a lot of the book is describing really amazing sights and, you know, stuff about the universe that does well when accompanied by some kind of visual representation, because it can be really, really hard to wrap your mind around some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I remember there's one chapter, you might have gotten to it, you might not have gotten to it, but it was about like how ancient civilizations figured out time, and I could not understand what he was saying. And there's like a 5-minute clip of Cosmos that he just does it, and it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
I didn't make it to that chapter.
So, Toby, is this officially a DNF? Like, you're not going to read it anymore? You're done?
I'm not going to finish it. Yeah, I'm done.
Ooh.
Pale Blue Dot DNF?
Yeah, unfortunately. I don't know how we're going to do that on Goodreads, but yeah. Sorry, Pejos.
I wonder if we've opened a Pandora's box here.
Yeah, I know. We never finish another book again.
I will be finishing my next book. I don't know if you listened to the last episode. It's pretty exciting.
Well, Andrew, tell us more about Carl Sagan.
Well, apparently Dylan and Toby both are obsessed with this dude, so we've heard a lot of the facts of him already, but I have some here. There was a lot about him online, so if you know some facts about Carl Sagan that I do not share, just know that it's because I had to make this fit a small section of the podcast. Carl Edward Sagan was born in Brooklyn on November 9th, 1934. He grew up in Bensonhurst with his mother, Rachel, and his father, Samuel, who had immigrated from Ukraine when it was still part of the Russian Empire. And he grew up in sort of a liberal reformed Jewish household and lived in Brooklyn for most of his childhood. He was there for the 1939 New York World's Fair and credits seeing them putting a time capsule in the ground for some of his later work on Voyager, where he was, you know, trying to preserve all of humanity, just like we preserve some of humanity at the World's Fair for future generations of humans.
Cool.
Cool.
Convincing. Very quickly, they figured out that this was a very smart little kid. And so he was very advanced academically, though he did have to relocate from Brooklyn to Rahway, New Jersey, and attended high school there, and basically like was like a straight A student who didn't try and was just like, this is too easy for me, give me something. And people were like, send him to a different school, send him to a private school. And his parents were like, we can't afford it. I'm like, okay, so instead we'll just send him to the University of Chicago at age 16.
Wow.
And that's what happened. So he graduated from high school early and attended University of Chicago at an early age, which was apparently not something you could really do at many other institutions at the time. So yeah, you might have guessed, really loved science fiction growing up, particularly H.G. Wells and Edgar Rice Burroughs. And from a very early age, loved Mars. Also from a very early age.
The God of War?
The God of War himself. No, was taken in by the idea of UFOs and flying saucers, but not like because he believed in them, because he's like, that can't be how it goes. from a very young age, he was skeptical and sort of laying the bedrock for some of his theories. So he went to University of Chicago, immediately started going ham on the curriculum there. He wanted to get paid to be an astronomer because that was what was interesting him. And so he got a BA, a BS, a Master of Science, and a Doctor of Philosophy, all in astrophysics from the University of Chicago.
Save some degrees for the rest of us, Sagan.
I know, right? And he worked with foremost people in the field, including a man named Harold Urey, who's a physical chemist, who'll come up in a little bit. So remember the name. And so also from a young age, he was, from a pretty young age coming out of school, he was like getting put on top secret missions from the government, including a plan from the Air Force to detonate a nuclear warhead on the moon to test it, which did not happen.
I was going to say, what?
I read a different book about that, about the plan.
Nuking the moon?
If you want to look it up, it's called Project A119.
There's a book called, I think it's even called The Attack on the Moon or something, but it's about like just insane government plans. And Carl Sagan is kind of brought in as like, and he's in his 20s and he has to explain to them, it's like, well, theoretically you could do it, but also this is a bad idea.
But also, are you sure?
Yeah. So he worked on that. He had top secret clearance. Apparently also accidentally revealed state secrets in like a letter to an editor or something. I don't have enough information on that to speak confidently, but he somehow also violated his top secret security clearance.
So you're saying he's kind of a bad boy. Got it.
His defense was, guys, we're just a pale blue dot.
He's then sort of bounced around in academia for a little bit. He went to UC Berkeley and worked there for a little bit, and then was sort of snatched up by Harvard to become a professor there. He also, while he was in California, was a planetary science consultant to the RAND Corporation. I mention that because the other author in this episode was also a consultant to the RAND Corporation, which I thought was a strange coincidence.
Ooh.
So he was at Harvard for a while, seemed to be doing well, but then was denied academic tenure. Apparently it was very unexpected. And the sort of story is that other professors, most notably his former advisor, Harold Urey, told him not to give him tenure.
What?
Because he was at this point like becoming more of a science communicator, and they were like, he's trying to do this for fame, not for science.
Oh.
But he pivoted well and went to Cornell, where he got tenure very quickly, and then worked there up until his death with varying degrees of like intensity. But he ran a lab there for planetary studies. So I'll let you guys look it up on your own if you want to look up some of his more scientific achievements. It's just not time on this podcast. Let's talk more about Cosmos, A Personal Voyage.
Mm.
It's a 13-part PBS television series, which was the most watched thing on PBS for over 10 years until 1990, when I believe a Ken Burns thing edged him out.
Yeah.
But it was like wildly popular, very much like science communication for the masses. It won him an Emmy and a Peabody Award. He also had been writing for a while before that, including a book called The Dragons of Eden, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1977. And that was sort of like what got PBS to be like, hey, you want to Cosmos it up with us, dog? Dylan has been, and Toby have both been referencing billions and billions, which is something that he said a lot in the show. It became like a very cultural moment. Like Johnny Carson made fun of it. A lot of comedians made it into a Frank Zappa song. It also became a code word at Apple for a product they were working on. And then Sagan like sent them a cease and desist letter because he's like, I don't want to be seen to be endorsing a product. And they're like, okay. And then they changed the name to Butthead Astronomer. BAH became the code instead because they called him Butthead.
Wow.
So thought that would be a fun thing. He was a big advocate of marijuana.
Yep.
And after his death, his wife joined the board of directors of NORML, or the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He credited it with helping format his writing. So there you go.
That tracks.
Nice.
Sagan contracted blood cancer, a specific kind of blood cancer, and after receiving over 3 bone marrow transplants, died from complications and pneumonia at age 62 in Seattle, and he is buried at Lakeview Cemetery in Ithaca, New York. He was married 3 times and had several children, some of whom continued his legacy and continued to write, and he was married finally to Anne Druyan, who he was married to until his death. So that's enough Sagan for now. Maybe we'll get a taste of him later.
Yeah, maybe Toby will read Contact.
Maybe Toby will finish reading this book.
Maybe he will. All right.
So that is Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. No rating.
No stars.
No rate. Unrated. The unrated version. Yeah, well, I'll say that learning that, you know, something has been shot into the vastness of space with our coordinates on it and basically announcing ourselves to the universe has given me the gift of trepidation. But Bailey, did you read a book this week?
Ooh, I did. I read The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker.
Ah!
Sweet Debecker.
That was a good one, Dill. Yeah, Toby, what you're describing is not fear. That's anxiety and worry. It's different. And I'll tell you more about it with my book. Okay, so I have a lot of thoughts about this book. Okay, where to begin? How I first got interested in this book, glad you asked. I was at a bachelorette party of my friend Camille, who's been on this podcast before. And she has many fancy friends. Some of them are like fancy screenwriters who've actually had their movies made. And I was talking to one of these women. We started talking about true crime. And then she started talking about The Gift of Fear. She's like, you have to read this book. And I was like, oh, well, you're really cool. So, you know, definitely. And like, it felt kind of cool that it was like this fancy person also has an obsession with true crime. So I'm like, okay, I'll check it out. And the pitch was to follow your intuition over your logic. So if you are walking down the street at night and a person comes up to you and you get a sense of, no, get out of here, follow that fear. That's essentially what the book is saying. You know, there's the quote, maybe it's Margaret Atwood, men are afraid of being laughed at and women are afraid of being killed. So like, it's very focused on women. And he acknowledges that, like, obviously this happens in other genders, but for the purpose of the book, he's using men aggressing women, that women have this innate sense of something's not right here, but I have to be polite and play along or he's going to be mad, because we have a sense of we don't want to make it awkward. But sometimes asserting yourself and making it awkward or being rude is better than the alternative. That is the thesis of the book. And he goes on in 300 pages to detail more examples of that, how he's experienced it in his life. He works as, or he did when this book was published in the 90s, at like a security firm. He's advised presidents and celebrities and this sort of thing. So he has seen it a lot. And so he's talking about his experiences. He talks a lot about specific clients, also about like history of like assassinations, this sort of thing, with all this thesis of follow your gut. He also outlines like several tips and tricks to follow your gut and signs that someone is sketchy and you should follow your gut. So I'm going to read a section of it just to give you a sense.
Just real quick, had you heard of this book before this fancy person mentioned it to you? Because I feel like I'd heard of it a long time ago. It's like as like a term. You just see, oh, you need to have the gift of fear.
Maybe vaguely, but if anything, I'd heard of it like kind of as a joke. And then this person validated for me like, no, there's good ideas in there. So that's my memory of it. But that was years ago. But in considering like the fact that some people are like talking about it like a joke, because it is kind of simplistic.
Yeah.
But this section sort of talks about how like we need to not qualify it and just go with it. So.
Yeah.
Can you imagine an animal reacting to the gift of fear the way some people do, with annoyance and disdain instead of attention? No animal in the wild, suddenly overcome with fear, would spend any of its mental energy thinking, it's probably nothing. Yet we chide ourselves for even momentarily giving validity to the feeling that someone is behind us on a seemingly empty street, or that someone's unusual behavior might be sinister. Instead of being grateful to have a powerful internal resource, grateful for the self-care, instead of entertaining the possibility that our minds might actually be working for us, and not just playing tricks on us, we rush to ridicule the impulse. We, in contrast to every other creature in nature, choose not to explore, and even to ignore, survival signals. The mental energy we use searching for the innocent explanation to everything could more constructively be applied to evaluating the environment for more important information. There's your thesis.
Nice.
With that said...
Wait a minute. I'm gonna say a theory that I have based on what you've already said.
Go for
it. Is this one of those books that feels like it could have been a 45-minute podcast?
More like a handout, but yes.
Ooh.
Well, okay. Orcs and elves. Elves. Good ideas in there. Strong theories. He also includes a fair amount of his experience growing up, which informs his gift of fear, and you can see why. Someone framed it as it's like a self-help book that reads like a thriller. That's true. He has a lot of like flowery language that puts you in this moment, this, you know, fearful moment, which is good. It's pro-women in a lot of ways. It's a lot of like, men might discount your feelings, but you should listen to them, which I appreciate. So it's definitely the most engaging self-help book I've ever read. It does pull you in. Another elf, an example of these good tips. It's kind of like justifying, like I've said, women's intuition, validating your fear or anxiety. So this is an example of that. He's describing something that sketchy people do called too many details, which is like when they're lying, they provide too many details. But if you're telling the truth, you don't feel the need to over-justify. You just kind of say something instead of providing a lot of context. So he says this. The person who recognizes the strategy of too many details sees the forest while simultaneously being able to see the few trees that really matter. When approached by a stranger while walking on some city street at night, no matter how engaging he might be, you must never lose sight of the context. He is a stranger who approached you. A good exercise is to occasionally remind yourself of where you are and what your relationship is to the people around you. With a date who stays beyond his welcome, for example, no matter how jokey or charming he may be, a woman can keep herself focused on context simply by thinking, I have asked him to leave twice. The defense for too many details is simple. Bring the context into conscious thought. So that's just a good tip because society tells us like, no, you're being hysterical, stop it. But if you just remind yourself, wait a second, this is objectively weird, validates your feelings.
It sounds good because like, I think that this book could be characterized as be terrified of strangers no matter what. But it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like it's a more measured thing.
Exactly. That actually leads to my first orc, which was my fear was going to be from the introduction, like the thesis was going to be scared of everything and have anxiety all the time, because that's the way to do it. And it's not. He talks more about being measured. He talks more about distinguishing worry from true fear, like I mentioned. And he also talks about the dangers of anxiety. With that said, as an anxious person, I don't know that he entirely made it clear when to trust your gut and when not to, or when to respond to the way your body is reacting and when not to. So I think that there could be a little more clarity there. But yes, I was worried it was going to be afraid of everything, but it's not exactly that.
And you would have asked him to clarify, but it would make it awkward.
Exactly. It would have been weird. And so I don't know. There's also another orc is this sense of smugness, the theme of the podcast, where like he'll be like, my client came in and she told me, you know, da 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 da, this is happening. I don't know how I had the feeling. And he'll say, but you did know. And she's like, you're right, I did know. It's a lot of like, okay, Yoda.
I was right.
Yoda slash, that's probably how he makes a lot of money. He's like, you know how much money you can make telling insecure rich people that they're right?
Yeah, exactly. But you know it all along.
I did know it all along. Mm.
I also wonder, and it's unexplored, what biases such as racism how that comes into play. Yeah. Like the feeling of like, I feel uneasy around this black person. I should trust that. Nope. Seems like it could lead to very problematic situations.
That's literally the first thing that popped up in my head when you described like the real theory of this book. I was like, I wonder if he addresses that. But it seems like no.
He does not. I would also like to get more information. Like we said, we get some of his childhood. We get a ton of him like at the top of his game with his clients. We don't get any explanation of how he got that job. Like, how did you become an expert in this? How did you get recognized? How are people paying you for this?
Well, that's what Andrew's there for.
That's true. And then lastly, last orc, and this is the copy I read was something I found in a little free library from the 90s. But then I also read a little bit of the audiobook. And the audiobook was updated in 2021. So there's a lot of random, you know, when it's like you're reading it and you can tell when they've added part of the sentence, you know what I mean? So like there'll be parts like da 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 da, and they'll be like, this is even worse in the age of cell phones because people are looking at their cell phones. Or, you know, people seem to be afraid of crazy things like worldwide pandemics, except when there is one right now. But the negative thing about that, besides it seeming a bit choppy, is that at the very, very end, he has these appendices, and one of them is about gun control and how guns make us feel safer, but they really are more dangerous and you need to like lock up guns, etc. And that was the original appendices. And then the addendum is, some people have accused me of being against gun control, and I'm not. I have this many guns and da 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 da. And that's like where the audiobook ends. And it feels problematic. It's like, why are you ending on this note where it just feels like he's asserting, I'm not political. I'm not saying I'm into gun control. I'm just saying to lock up your guns, but that's not gun control. Anyway, look over there. Just felt like a little distracting. So
yeah,
all in all, I'm going to give it 3 stars. Honestly, I might have given it 4 were it not for those weird addendums, just because it was, like I said, the most engaging self-help. Could it be summarized in an email? Sure. But I found it engaging. 3 stars.
Nice. And I assume that Andrew has billions and billions of facts, right?
About Gavin DeGraw?
Not Gavin DeGraw. Did you get the wrong facts?
Oh, I did the facts on Gavin DeGraw.
Yes.
Okay, well, Gavin DeGraw was born. no, I have facts on
Gavin DeGraw Tyson, right?
Yes, exactly. Gavin DeBecker was born on October 26, 1954, and he is an American author and security specialist. A lot of the facts I've seen about him keep saying reportedly, or like they would say something, and then in a different paragraph, it would be like, reportedly, this is true, or like maybe this happened, whereas like earlier it said like that definitely happened. So just, you know, if I'm wrong, Gavin, please don't sue me.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of citations to his work.
So he runs a company called Gavin DeBecker and Associates. And this is our first reportedly. Reportedly, he's a billionaire because of this.
Wow.
And he runs it, which is a security firm, and he founded it in 1978. And it's like an advisory company about like protecting, particularly it protects like famous people and politicians and like manages their security. But let's talk a little bit about him as a young man, because there might be something that surprises you here. So his father was Hal DeBecker, whose name you might know if you are a fan of dance. He was an American dancer and a prolific writer about dance. So he comes from the DeBecker stock. Sadly, his mother died by suicide when he was 16, and he then moved in with a friend. His friend was Miguel Ferrer. Does anyone know who that is?
Actor?
Yep, he recently passed away. You would definitely recognize his face. He's in Twin Peaks. He's in NCIS Los Angeles. You would recognize this man.
Okay.
Played the vice president in Iron Man 3. And he's also the son of Jose Ferrer and Rosemary Clooney. So.
Oh, wow.
So Gavin DeBecker was living with Miguel Ferrer, a.k.a. George Clooney's cousin. and then exactly how he got the job he has is a little unclear, but I'll say what I found out.
Okay.
He ended up being Rosemary Clooney's like road manager.
Okay.
And then that opened the door for him to become an assistant to people in Hollywood. He was Elizabeth Taylor's assistant. It seems like he kind of just lucked into having access to a certain world. So yeah, he wrote an article when he was 21 that was picked up by the Department of Justice and made available to every police department in the United States. So like,
wow.
He has some sort of preternatural understanding of like security theory, but I can't find any information about how he got that.
Yeah, I have the same question.
Again, the articles I was reading didn't really have information on that. It just sort of more summarized it. But he seems to understand it. And he was 21 when he released that. And then he subsequently co-designed the Mosaic Threat Assessment System, which was initially designed to screen threats to the Supreme Court justices. And then that ended up being extended to members of Congress, people in the CIA, and then like a lot of like police departments have used that as well when like, doing threat assessment. And then he also just kept his Hollywood credentials and investigated stalkers for the likes of Olivia Newton-John, Sheena Easton, and Cher. And then provided security services to people like Richard Burton, Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, Joan Rivers, Tina Turner, and John Travolta.
Wow, you can really tell the era that he got his big contracts in, can't you?
Yeah.
Those are all celebrities of a certain era.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he just sort of, I think, gained prominence through this. He worked, again, with the Department of Justice doing various things. He served with the Governor's Advisory Board of California and the Department of Mental Health, updating their threat assessment systems. And then that has, like, burgeoned into the sort of celebrity with his book, The Gift of Fear, which was released in 1997. That was, like, it solidified a lot of what he's been trying to tell people, and it rose him to a level of prominence, and he's appeared on shows for, you know, 60 Minutes, Oprah Winfrey, Larry King, a lot of that, more and more and more, and written things up for a bunch of different publications.
I was going to say, I think Oprah has a lot to do with his success. She like touted him and like every woman should read this book, etc.
And then he also has assisted directly with the Secret Service, which leans into what he's sort of doing today. More recently, he's been working very closely with Jeff Bezos, specifically with some threats he's been having from the Saudi Arabian government, who have been like hacking his phones apparently, allegedly. And most recently, he's been very entwined with the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. presidential campaign, including donating $10 million to a super PAC that supports RFK. But he had $9.65 million of that returned to him. A few fun last facts about him. As I referenced, Miguel Ferrer, in the television show Twin Peaks, based his character on Gavin DeBecker. So if you rewatch Twin Peaks, you can see his character, who is FBI agent Albert Rosenfield. That's based on DeBecker. Robert De Niro met with DeBecker in preparation for his role in The Fan. Meryl Streep also, who described DeBecker as a friend, said The Gift of Fear informed her portrayal of a nun in the 2008 movie Doubt.
Gift of Fear and Doubt, yeah.
Yeah, The Gift of Fear appears on Walter White's nightstand in season 2, episode 12. Of Breaking Bad. And DeBecker delivered a eulogy at Carrie Fisher's memorial service. Apparently they attended high school together. This is another one of the reported ones. And then finally, the 2022 film Barbarian was inspired by The Gift of Fear.
Yep.
That is so satisfying. I feel like when I was watching that with you, Dylan, I just kept being like, Gift of Fear, girl, get out, Gift of Fear.
I heard an interview with the screenwriter and director of that, who basically, he said he read The Gift of Fear and wanted to design a scenario that was like the most Gift of Fear scenario you could possibly have. And that's like the opening 15 minutes of that movie.
Yeah, interesting.
And finally, in the 1990s, DeBecker was a little bit of a playboy and was romantically linked to Alanis Morissette and Gina Davis, though he then was married in 2007 to his current wife, with whom he has two sons. Another person who had a lot about him online, and I hope this is a good, like, a quick summary of him, even though most of it is alleged or reportedly.
But when did he write Chariot?
He wrote Chariot in 2004 after a bad breakup with Ashley Simpson.
Oh, Gavin. Sorry.
Anyway, great facts, Andrew.
Thank you for being on top of Dylan's reference. I was like, he had a book named Chariot. Yeah. I don't get it. Anyway, okay. So that is The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. 3 stars.
3 stars. Andrew, after giving us such amazing facts, do you have an equally amazing game?
Not for me to say, Toby, but I can try.
Okay.
The name of the game this week is Modern Astronomy. Are you ready to play?
Ready.
Yeah, but I don't care about space that much.
Well, this could be hard for you, Toby.
Maybe this is going to be tough.
So here's the game.
I do care about games, though.
It's true. All three of you can play.
Ooh, Dylan, you get to play.
Let me paint a scenario for you. I'm no longer Andrew. I am now a head of an ad campaign business, an advertising organization. And let me tell you, we got a problem.
Okay.
The planets' names are boring.
Oh.
Who cares about them? Those are old Roman names for Greek gods. That's so 2,000, 3,000 years ago. We need to rebrand them for a modern audience. So kids are really into, I don't know what, Euphoria, pogo sticks. I don't know any children. But we need to make sure the next generation of children are into these planets. So we need to rebrand them. So what you need to do is each come up with a new name and a justification for why you're renaming a planet something more modern and exciting for the next generation. Basically, I want you guys to be real silly renaming planets. We're going to start with 5 of them. If this works, we'll come back and maybe rebrand the rest of them. But we're going to start with 5. There'll be 5 rounds. You each can submit. There'll be a winner for each round. There'll be a tiebreaker at the end if we remain tied. 1 point is available for each round. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ready.
So I know Mars is big and exciting, but it's named after what? A god of war? That's nothing to me. What should we call Mars going forward in the modern world?
I'm going to call it It's Giving, which is a cool thing that kids say. Like, it's giving, red. It's giving water on Mars. I'm going to call it It's Giving.
It's Giving. I learned this term a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to call it Ice Spice.
Ice Spice. Okay, we have Ice Spice and It's Giving. That's wonderful.
Okay, I'm going to call it Reese's because it's a superior candy.
Toby doesn't Mars. Know any teens.
And good. It's Moon Gra.
All right, the point goes here to Dylan with Ice Spice. I think the kids are really going to respond to that and want to come to my astronomy classes. So, all right, next round. It may be the planet closest to the sun, but I just think it's boring. Mercury.
Ooh, I've got this one. Okay. So we're going to rename this one Maya Rudolph's appearance on SNL as Beyonce on Hot Ones.
It does trip off the tongue.
I'm just going to name it TikTok Famous because TikTok is a way to communicate. And, you know, Mercury is the messenger. So TikTok Famous.
And I'll go Dua Lipa.
Dua Lipa.
All right, this round goes to Maya Rudolph's appearance on SNL as Beyonce in Hot Ones by Toby.
Yes.
Because I think it's Perfect. And Bailey is going more for concepts here. And I think Dylan is just going to keep throwing out celebrities without really justifying why, even though Ice Spice made sense because of her hair. Anyhow. All right. 1 point for Dylan. 1 point for Toby. Bailey, you need to get on the board to keep it close. And you got a big opportunity here for the biggest planet in the solar system, Jupiter.
Jupiter is going to be now called No Cap. Because that's a cool thing people say to be like, I'm not lying. Because you can be like, how big is that planet? And you'd be like, no cap, it's the biggest.
I'm going to go Cowboy Cotter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And any reasoning why? Just going to go with it? Your downfall for Dua Lipa was you gave no justification. You just named a famous
place. Dua Lipa needs no justification.
The justification was it has the fastest orbit. So like how she says that she'll go Houdini. So she'll disappear. You have to be quick to get her to because she'll go before
you
she
already lost that
right.
round. Please how about you just about the planet. We're justifying your Jupiter answer here, but you've lost your opportunity to speak. Toby, what's your answer?
No.
I'm going to say my answer is pastel green bucket hat because it just would look so good on Jupiter.
Well, you're not wrong, Toby, but I am going to give the point here to Bailey because I think that was, of the answers Bailey's given, that's the most acceptable.
Thank you.
So you're all tied at one.
All right. A weak win there, but sure.
I'm not going to lie. A weak round. Do better.
Fair.
This one, you know, controversial. It's been designated a bunch of different things. We got to know what we're going to call Pluto, even if it's a microplanet, macroplanet, whatever. I don't care. I just need to be able to sell planet t-shirts. What are we calling him?
I'm going to go with a pretty L.A. reference here and call it Erewhon, because that's where I think you could buy a big thing of, like, microgreens.
I'm going to go with JoJo Siwa, because it thinks that it's a pop star, but it's not, and it's trying to artificially make itself a pop star again.
Oh.
Hot take.
Not that hot of a take. Pretty accepted take of...
medium take.
I'm going to go with Austin Butler being unable to get rid of the Elvis accent. Because it's something that can't be denied, but they might try to hide it, but it happened.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think y'all know that Bailey won that round.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. All right. Well, then it all comes down to this last round, and it's a big one. What are we going to call Earth? Because I don't like it.
Oh.
I think it's boring. It's the same name as the ground. What the heck?
I'm going to call it Lana Del Rey. Because it's toxic, but also has like a very rose-tinted view of its past and everything. It is very self-destructive.
I'm gonna call it mommy. Like, there's a lot of mommy going around social media these days. So,
I'm gonna call it Gavin DeGraw.
Yep, the hot reference for the kids. The clear winner there is mommy.
Yes.
Dylan, unfortunately, you're fired. Oh. Bailey and Toby, we're keeping you on because of your great answers. But we need a tie break here. So with 2 points each, there's a big boy in the system that it's all based around. And that's the sun. But I don't like the name. So what are we going to call the sun?
Just trying to think about what, you know, Gen Z revolves around.
I'm going to call it social anxiety because everyone's thinking about it, but you don't want to look at it too directly.
I'm going to call it the gift of warmth.
Almost said the gift of fear.
Not my best.
Could have gone with Jacob Elordi's bathwater.
Yeah.
Oh.
But the winner is Toby. Come on, that was great.
Yeah.
Good job.
We now live in a solar system revolving around social anxiety on planet Mommy. Just mere steps away from Ice Spice. All right. That was great. Thank you very much.
I mean, that describes my life to a T, to be honest.
It does.
Yeah,
great
job. I think we've really nailed it. Congratulations, Toby, on your win.
Good job, Toby.
Oh, thank you.
All right. On that note, good job in the game. Good performance, Toby. Let's let Dylan, you know, back on our planet. It's time for him to choose books at random from our shelves. I do feel a genuine worry, not fear, about what will be chosen next. It's time for the choosing.
I went there too, Andrew, given the way you said genuine.
Yeah.
Genuine fear. Tell me my book.
Will we have more nonfiction, Dylan, or will we finally be able to read fiction again?
I don't know. Bailey, will we have more nonfiction? Another big, heavy World War II book? Maybe a presidential biography? Or would we have some light reading, like Number 9 Beach Read by Emily Henry for Bailey.
Ah, well, this just reminds me about how Lin-Manuel Miranda read Hamilton on the beach. I'm thrilled about this. I've read a little Emily Henry. I've read Happy Place, and this is romance. I think this is one of her most beloved, if not the most beloved. I think there's one called Book Lovers too, but Beach Read, Emily Henry,
this
romance.
Is huge.
I'm into it.
And Toby.
Mm-hmm.
When Carl Sagan was describing the cosmos, did he talk about the great tools of space, the great woodworking of the universe, the great number 14, The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin?
Ooh, yes. Ooh, I'm amped.
Le Guin is in.
It's Le Guin. She's in. There's nothing more to say. I'm very excited. I don't think I've ever read anything by Le Guin that wasn't 5 stars. So I'll just say it right now. I'm calling it 5 stars.
Wow.
It's going to be great.
4 weeks hence, I DNF this book.
Turns out I don't care that much about lathes.
Okay, so that means in 2 weeks on the podcast, I will be reading Beach Read by Emily Henry, and Andrew is reading The Splendid and the Vile by our boy, Eric Larson.
Chaboy.
Thanks for listening to The To Read List. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can email thetoreadlistpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Goodreads, Instagram, and the Storygraph @thetoreadlistpodcast.
Pages, I know you wish you could rate us billions and billions of stars, but you can do the next best thing, which is you can go onto your podcatcher of choice and rate us 5 stars, which is as many as they'll let you do. If you want to make a reference to billions and billions or say something great about us, you can go down and write a review. We really appreciate it. It helps raise the visibility of the podcast, and we love to read reviews.
And another way to help us out and find new listeners is if you could, I don't know, tell your friends, Carrie Fisher, Cher, Olivia Newton-John.
Allegedly. Reportedly.
You tell all your friends and clients about our podcast. Word of mouth is the best way to find new listeners, and we really appreciate it.
Love it.
The gift of FOMO.
And also, actually, can you tell Meryl Streep that she's great?
Thanks to Toby and Andrew for co-hosting the podcast with me, to Dylan for sound recording, and to Miss Jillian Beth Durkee for composing our intro song. See you in 2 weeks. Happy reading.
Books, books, books. Books. Books.